I am Pat Clater from Austin. And I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. This is a bigger crowd than I expected. We were sitting out on the benches, and somebody walked by and says, "Are you going to the Al-Anon meeting?" And I said, "Well, if you do, you can sleep through it." So I'm going to keep you awake, but I'm going to yell every now and then. I want to thank you, committee, for asking me. It is a privilege and an honor. And for those of you that haven't been to this type of conference before, it's so special. And I love a lot of people that are in this room. A lot of them I've been knowing through the years. And I'm just really glad to be here. I had a little basket in my room full of all these little goodies. And there was a note in it. And the note says, it says, "Pat, thanks for coming. If you need anything, don't bother me." So, but I know that the person that wrote that, if I need anything, she does not consider it a bother, and I appreciate that. She has been in places when I didn't have to ask her. She wasn't one of these that says, "If there's anything you need, call me." I never had to call, and she was there. And I thank you. I also had something else. I asked Vinod if he's all right if I read my speech. And the air was blue. And someone gave this to me several years ago. And it says, you know it's a bad day when. And it says, you know it's a bad day when you want to put on the clothes you wore to the party and there aren't any. And, or the sun comes up in the west. Or you jump out of bed in the morning and miss the floor. Oh, the bird singing outside of your window is a buzzard. And your income tax return bounces. You put your bra on backwards and it fits better. And this one always just gives me chills. Which one is it? Oh, your horn gets stuck when you're following a group of Hell's Angels down the highway. So I added one more this morning, and that was, you know it's going to be a bad day if I'd had to stay in my room all day with the way that our room looks. Now, there's a point at every conference that high on my gratitude list is the fact that I'm not in a women's prison. I really do love women. And we've had some real, you know, some real neat conferences. But let me tell you, Jack's the best roommate I've ever had. And he doesn't clutter like you all do. I was born, let me see, I got to check my, I got to tell you all good news too. My watch was stopped a while ago. I think it's going now. Don't you hope. I was born in a little town out on the South Plains of Texas called Floydada. And we went to Fort Worth to a Fat Stock show one time, and my aunt was driving, and she was going the wrong way on a one-way street, and the policeman stopped her and looked at her driver's license, and he said, "Floyd, da-da." He says, "No wonder you don't know which way to go." And I moved to Petersburg when I was 6 months old. I was moved to Petersburg, this little tiny town. And my dad was in the grain business, had grain elevators. And I think about my growing up. It was a safe place for little girls to grow up and could walk. I didn't know anybody that ever had a divorce until I was nearly grown. Everybody just stayed put, stayed together. And my dad was in the grain business. I was the firstborn, and he thought I was really special. I was a blessed child. I was loved, and I knew it. And I'm grateful for the love that I've been given. And so growing up to me was a nice experience. I had and this really dates me. I'm 63 years old. It always bothers me if people start talking and I'm trying to figure out how old they are. But now this really does sound OLD because I had a sinus infection that developed into osteomyelitis of the skull, and penicillin wasn't invented. There weren't even any antibiotics. And I was really, really sick. And the doctor told my mother and daddy that the chances of my survival were very slim, and that if I lived, I'd probably either be retarded or blind. And when I was in the hospital, this man came and stood at my door, and he says, "Little girl, God really has something in mind for you." And he says, "There have been an awful lot of prayers said for you." Well, I'm telling you, that really did feel heavy. I figured right then and there I was probably, you know, set aside to find the cure for cancer. And but after my first year of college, and I made D's in all the sciences, I did start out to major in pre-med, but I majored mostly in bridge and boys, so I decided that it probably wasn't me, that I was just supposed to sort of be the incubator, you know, and I found that it was a lot easier for me to have babies than it was to pass chemistry. So I kind of, you know, thought, I probably am, that's probably what I meant to be. So I stopped worrying about, am I taking this? Thank you. But anyway, during college, when I went home for one time, this lieutenant was there. And it was when they wore the eyes and had the pinks and had this little waist, and he was tall, and I thought he was really neat. And when Jack had marched off to World War II, I was 14, and he just didn't pay a whole bunch of attention to me. And when he came back, I was 19, and a few things had shifted. And I was determined, and I asked him for the first date. One of my friends was having a business sorority dance, and I asked Jack to go with me. He was working on an alfalfa dehydrator for my dad. He had just gotten his discharge from the service, and I was, after a manner of speaking, keeping books. I hadn't thought about this in a long time, but I kept a record player down there, and one of the songs that was real popular at this time was Doing What Comes Naturally, and we did, and 3 months later, we were married, and people in Petersburg can count real good, and we had a little boy named Kent. And all the bunch in Petersburg mostly had married high school sweethearts and were coming back to, and we mostly had grandparents that would take care of our children. And it was a dry town. Amarillo was the nearest wet place. That was 100 miles away. But there was a bootlegger named Bruce. And I learned how to drink. I didn't learn how good because Jack taught me how to take a drink of whiskey, take another drink of Coke. And this wasn't my idea of sophistication, you know. But we'd go out to Bruce's, and she had a farm. And you asked what brand she had, and she knew where they were. But she'd march off so many rows, 7 rows this way, and dig up the bottle. And it was hot. It was hot from heat, and it was hot from... Then if we didn't have Coke, Jack told me I could inhale and keep the smoke down and then take a drink. And I'd seen these pictures of Seagram's, B.O., you know, and the men had on tux, and the women nearly always had on a white dress with just one sleeve in it. And drinking out of a bottle just didn't fit that picture too good. But you just don't get too sophisticated in Petersburg, Texas, you know. It's about 700 people. But we'd have the dances at the American Legion on Saturday nights. And it got to be just sort of an accepted thing, you know, that half the American Legion would help me take Jack home. He would, as he says it, he would lie in state, and the American Legion people would dance by and look at him, and he'd have his arms crossed, and he just needed the lily, and I'd stay till the party was over, and then help me take Jack home. And I asked him one time, I said, "Jack, do you really not remember what happened last night? I'd fill him in, you know." And he'd say, "Well, no." And I said, "That would just scare me to death." And he said, "Pat, do you mean to tell me that you remember everything you say and do?" And I just sort of, well, he said, "If I were you, I wouldn't admit it." So we did drink together. I was his drinking buddy. I was determined to be his drinking buddy because togetherness had been my motto before McCall's ever thought about it. And Jack's dad was one of the town drunks in this little bitty town, and my dad did not drink often, but when he did, something really bad always happened. And my mother, both our mothers abhorred liquor in any form. And my daddy, if he ever drank, if he was going to be on his breath, he was going to catch hell when he got home anyway. So about two or three times a year, he would get really drunk. And something always really bad did happen. And somebody asked me one time if my dad was an alcoholic, and I said, I don't know. He didn't drink that much. I never thought about him being an alcoholic. But when one of our sons showed behavior problems the same way, you know, they both drank fighting whiskey. And so I don't know. And I'm not one that just sits around and analyzes, you know. I never have just, you know, enjoyed looking at my navel and gazing and thinking too much about it. So I really don't know, but I was so determined that I was not going to make the mistakes that either of our mothers did. And if Jack wanted to drink, then I was going to drink with him. And I think all of us have ideas about what an alcoholic is. I had three. You don't drink by yourself. An alcoholic drinks by himself. If you're not, you drink with people. Well, I just that crossed over the line and makes damn sure he wasn't drinking by himself. Also, 5 o'clock, you don't drink before. I didn't mean to say damn. I was just going to be so pure. But anyway, you don't drink before 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Well, it got stretched sometime to be 5 o'clock in Afghanistan or somewhere. And the other one was that, you know, you really didn't live in houses and things. You were down on the Bowery. And so anyway, these were my ideas of what an alcoholic was. And I don't think I even heard the word alcoholic. People were drunks, or there were a lot of other terms. But Jack's dad was a sweet, gentle man who could quote Plato and had a vocabulary all his own. I had to learn how to talk or to listen when I married into the family, because he would ask me to, he'd say, Patcher, would you pass the tarps? And I'd look all around the table, and that was his name for biscuits, and everything had a nickname. And he was a really neat man, and it was definitely a evidence of the disease of alcoholism, and it is an insidious illness. Let's see, we married, and we were living in Petersburg, we had Kent, and 30 minutes later had Christy. She was a little blonde, blue-eyed baby girl, and we were going to parties, and I was determined to, if he wanted a companion, then it was going to be me. My mother never gave me a whole lot of advice, but she said, the dishes will wait, the beds will wait, sometimes a man doesn't. So boy, if he said go, I'd beat him to the car. And we did have fun. It was not all doom and misery. We had the parties at the American Legion. Jack was recalled back in the service to the Korean outbreak, and it probably saved our marriage, because we'd been married 5 years then, babies 2 and 3 or 4, whatever they were, and the bloom was sort of off the rose. He didn't like me worth a hoot, and he thought I spent too much money, and I thought he didn't help enough, and we really just were not, our marriage was just not the warm, glowing relationship it could have been. So I think it was sort of a relief to him to have to go over and fight a war legally. So I learned a lot. I learned a lot when he was gone. And I think I really knew how much I wanted to work on the marriage. And I think I knew how much work you have to do in a marriage. And there were a lot of things I didn't know. I stood in line for the longest time to get license tags one time, and I didn't know you had to have the little title. There were a lot of things I had to learn, and it was good. I needed some maturing. So I really did commit to the marriage. I had promised to love, honor, and obey. No, I don't think I did say obey. If I did, delete that. But I made another commitment to the marriage, that the marriage was bigger than the two of us. And that even on days when I didn't like him, I was committed to the marriage. And I think we both made that commitment more than once. Because now, after being married for a long, long time, there are still days that we don't like each other worth a hoot. But someone told me, I always just make up figures because I can't ever remember them. So somebody told me that about 272 times in the Bible it says, and it came to pass. And nowhere does it say, and it came to stay. So I know that on those days that we don't like each other, this too shall pass. And there's an underlying love. And I think that respect and courtesy are so important with each other. Sometimes we do that better in our meetings than we do at home. But Jack went into the insurance business, and I used to tell people that because I know so definitely it is a family illness. And Jack just as generously shared his illness with me as he has his program of recovery, and I'm grateful. I'm grateful for that. I never was made to feel different. I never was made to feel like you don't really understand. Jack used to tell people that if he could have hung on a week and a half longer, or I'd have drunk a pint and a half, I probably would have joined him in the other room. And I don't know. I do know that some of my drinking patterns were not just whatever normal is. I know now that with what I know about the disease of alcoholism, that I don't care to play Russian roulette. I don't plan to find out, because all my knowledge of cancer may not prevent me from contracting it. And when the big book talks about knowledge avails us nothing, a lot of knowing about the disease. There are people out there that know a lot about the disease of alcoholism, and they got it. And they're not as blessed as we are this morning. So, for whatever, but we kept on drinking. When he came back from Korea, we moved to Houston. And we didn't drink out of the bottle anymore. I got to drink out of the long-stemmed glasses and wear the white one-sleeve dresses if I wanted to. And we were called on to entertain a lot when the best environment, because we could stay out all night, you know. And I look back now, I think, I wonder why I thought it was so much fun to wake up to filled ashtrays and smelly glasses. You know, that just today, this morning, in this beautiful, gorgeous place does not sound like fun to me. But this is what we did a lot of. Jack had a cardinal rule that he didn't drink during working time. He'd wait until 5 o'clock, and his job was an 8-to-5 job. And then we moved to Lubbock. I had a brother who was killed in a grain accident, and my dad had asked Jack if he'd consider moving back to Lubbock and going into business with him in the grain business. And I was really skittish about this. I'm not sure that family businesses are always the best idea, but I had written a letter to my mother today, telling him that we did drink. I didn't want to always be feeling like their little girl, you know, come over and be hiding something, you know. So I wrote and said that we had drinks, but it was at this time that the rule of 5 o'clock got bent all out of shape. Jack had a Ranchero pickup with a phone, and I don't think I ever got to call him. He was never in pocket or left it off the hook or something, but the 8-to-5 routine was no longer there. It's a seasonal business and real busy during certain times, and then lots of slack time. And this is the point when I remember, probably I didn't, but figuratively stood in the living room and just thinking, there's got to be more than this. I was still trying to keep up with him drinking. We had a little boy in Houston named Kyle. So we had three children. Kent and Chris were teenagers, and Kyle was about 4. And we were like 5 people living in separate compartments. And I couldn't keep up with Jack. You know, I would still be trying to drink. We weren't having fun. We were each other's companions. And he had his business people, and I had the people I knew. But we weren't going out. And it was not feeling good. And one day, Kyle walked in, and his little arms were filled with half pints of vodka. Vodka bottles. And I never had known Jack to drink vodka. He'd always been open with his drinking. And then I knew why I couldn't keep up anymore. He would buy a fifth, and he'd drink just enough out of it for me to know, you know, that he'd had a drink. But then he'd have the half pint of vodka before he got home. So I was beginning to feel a real apartness in the same room. There was a whole lot of apartness. And I filled this with a lot of stuff, played bridge a lot, didn't like my house at all. And one of the elevators in Florida, the manager's wife had gotten sick, and Jack had gone over to see about things over there, and it was in October. And the World Series was on, and Jack had told me he'd be home after the game. So I had the potatoes all wrapped in their little silver foil jackets and the steaks ready to broil, and gave him an extra hour after the ball game was over to get home. And then I turned the TV on, and the game had been rained out. And so then I readjusted the time, and the time came, and the time went, and everybody that waits at home for someone who has a drinking problem knows the feeling, like you've undigested bread in the pit of your stomach. And then the anger. And Blanche D. from Texas says, Al-Anon's come in one of two ways, either a dictator or a doormat. And I was not a doormat. So when he walked in, it was not a friendly atmosphere. And he said, Pat, I need to talk to you. And we went back in the bedroom, and he said, I've got to have help with my drinking. And I said, Jack, I don't know whether I care enough to do anything or not. And but he had reached a point that whether I chose to or not, he had reached a point that he was ready for help. And I'm so grateful that it did not depend on me, because he had gone by and asked his dad for help, and the following Monday night he went to his first AA meeting. We went to our first AA meeting on Saturday night at Central Club in Lubbock the following Saturday night. And because I was still so gung-ho on togetherness, you know, that whatever he was going to do, I was going to do it right by his warm side, you know, even angry or not. But I was standing upside the refrigerator, and a man who had known Jack, and Jack was in an insurance agency now, which he's done most of our married life. But I was standing by the refrigerator, and this man came up, and he said, Miss Clater, do you have a drinking problem? And I said, yeah, I really do, a 6-foot-4 one. And I believe that just as long as my online group let me get by with it. And I didn't get a sponsor, because I surveyed the room, and I could read as good as any of those ladies in there did. And I didn't see any of them I thought were any smarter or as smart. And so I just decided I could figure it out by myself. I just listened. And when I came into Al-Anon, it was the tail end of auxiliary type Al-Anon. It still was sort of a feeling, you know, if he's sober and you get to clean up the cups, you got to be grateful. But it was beginning to change. It was beginning to be seen that something else had to be besides just talking about them for it to work. So Jack and I went to meetings, and it was so neat. It was like every meeting was like a miracle, you know. We were just so excited about what was happening to people. A little bit of communication. The first real communication was just talking about the people at the meeting. But that was a real beginning. So when I needed to talk about the problem, I couldn't talk about the problem to the problem. So at this point in time, the pain overrode the pride, and I asked for a sponsor. My sponsor was Octavia from Lubbock, and Johnny was Jack's sponsor, and they're married to each other. And Octavia's been help to me. And one of the things she said is that she wanted to give it to me straight. She wanted to give it to me pure, because if she needed it back, she wanted to make sure she got it back right. And I still believe this. Had very little Al-Anon literature, none of her hardbacks. This sounds OLD too, doesn't it? But I think it's so exciting to be in the pioneer. We're still in sort of pioneer times. You know, this is not this old. AA is not as old as I am, and I'm not that old. There are two words in our house, two four-letter words we don't use in our house, and one of them is P-R-I-D-E, and the other one's O-L-D. But the things that she told me, we went to Cedar Glen, and it was a conference much like this, and I'd had a real spiritual coming-out party. And I felt just so, you know, on the mountain high top with God. And when I came in, I stood by Octavia's bunk, and I'd always had such a horror of being goody good, you know. I just never did like women that were so good. They just really just made me kind of sick. And I know I would always, sometimes I just sling out a four-letter word just to let you know I wasn't one of them. And so I told Octavia, I said, Octavia, you know, it really worries me. I'm afraid I'm just going to get too good. And Octavia looked at me, and she has snapping black eyes, and she said, Pat, you've got a lot of things to worry about.
But getting too good ain't one of them. So, and she did something else for me that I hope that I can do for someone. She never stepped on a miracle. She never topped what had just happened to me. She didn't let me get halfway through a neat experience and interrupt me with, yeah, and let me tell you what happened to me. She'd let me do it and be glad for me. I don't always do that because I had a blown tube, and I just bounce. I'm like the bouncing ball, and I don't know what year we're in, but you just have to keep up. We are here today is where we are. But I, with a group of AA women and Al-Anons, we had started a prayer group. We didn't call it Al-Anon AA. Don't get upset. but I was on my way to this, you know, and it was like, the sixth and seventh steps had been showing up real vividly in Jack's life. And I was seeing things happen in his life, and they weren't happening in mine. I was really surveying that. And so this little inside voice said, would you be willing not to talk today at this group? Now, I looked around because I knew it wasn't me, because I just love to talk. And I thought, I don't see how talking can be a character defect. No, I'm not willing. I'm not willing. I've said so much good stuff to say. And I feel like sometimes I'm going to explode if I don't get to share this good stuff, you know. But I really do know talking too much is a character defect. Someone said that listening is the purest form of humility. And it really is, you know. When I care enough to sit and look in your eyes and hear what you're saying to me, we really do have a language of the heart. And there has to be a listener. And I need to practice more at this. And thank you for those of you that have let me talk too much sometimes. But the sixth and seventh steps, when I saw it really make such tremendous changes in Jack's life, and what he says is, I think it's the neatest thing. He says, when we ask God to remove these character defects, he says to ask him to remove the need for these things. I ask him to remove the need for me to be angry with you. Ask for him to remove the need for me to be sarcastic. And this helps me a lot, and so I think it's always so neat that we do. There's always somebody just ahead to look to, and somebody just behind that you can reach out a hand to and walk along together. And this is exciting. The new people. There's a new Al-Anon here, and I just loved looking at her face last night. It was neat. In the big book, in the family afterward, it says, cessation of drinking is but the first step away from a highly strained, abnormal condition. A doctor said to us, years of living with an alcoholic is almost sure to make any wife or child neurotic. The entire family is to some extent ill. And this is so true, and families do get sick together, and we have to get well together. And it's an exciting journey. We had our 25th a year celebration in our programs, and we rented a hall and had Benoit and her gang came from Dallas, and they blew up balloons, and we got the barbecue catered, and people got up and said nice things about us and not nice things about us, and it was good. And it's the only time I ever had, and the only time I ever intend to ask our children, and I tried to be as tactful as I could, but I asked them to come without their spouses and children. They were not a part of the illness. They weren't there when it was happening. They've seen the fruits and the results of the process of recovery. But Kent came from Tennessee. He's permanent Navy. He's been in the Navy since he was 17. He's 42 now. He came, and he's tall like Jack and gentle like Jack, and he's married to a beautiful girl from Taiwan, and we have poor little black-eyed, black-haired grands that are just beautiful. And Christy came from Tennessee, too. Her husband is a veterinarian radiologist,
and was at the University of Tennessee, and she came, and Christy and Michael have given us four grands. Two of them will be graduating, and they just adopted a three-year-old little bombshell, little blue-eyed girl, 3 years old, named Tiffany, and she's a joy to us. But they came, and Kyle was there. Kyle lives in Austin, and I don't know how to tell you what Kyle does. Kyle bees Kyle. People say, how is Kyle? And I said, Kyle is. Everybody likes Kyle. And he and I sort of do a dance of the porcupines, you know. I just love him so much, and I can't get, we don't get very close because we're pretty prickly with each other. And so he helped build Willie Nelson's set for his movie, and he plays golf with some of the names sometimes, and he just loves that. And his aunt, I'm digressing from the party, but when Jack's brother died, well, the aunt gave Kyle his brother's Cadillac. It's just a beautiful car. And I think this is just, this can describe Kyle to me. Kyle's driving this absolutely gorgeous Cadillac, and very seldom he ever has money to buy gas for it. was back at the party, and as people got up there and shared the different things that had happened through the years, and when our kids stood up, you know, and there was a real healing that weekend to see our grown kids, to see how they Kent has 5 years in the program, and we sat up till 2:30 talking about how we understand God or we don't understand God, and we don't understand Him the same. But we did allow each other the privilege of that. And Christy is just about as near perfect as anybody can be, you know. And if I had just had her, I would have written 10 books on how to raise kids. But God saw fit to give me Kent and Kyle. And let me tell you, they have been my spiritual sandpaper on every side. They have rubbed me raw, and I have loved them so much that it hurts, and I want to kill them sometimes so much that that hurts. And when Jack came in, when he reached the point that beyond which he wanted to go no farther, he came by and talked to his dad, and he said, "Dad, I got to have help with my drinking." And on that day, Jack's dad had 14 and a half years sobriety in AA, and this town drunk was no longer. He was a respected citizen. And one day we got a call, and it was our son, and I said, "How you doing, Kent?" And he said, "Fine." And he said, "No, I'm not." He said, "Can I talk to Dad?" And he said to his dad, "I've got a drinking problem. And we've got to have help." So the disease goes on. Just knowing about it doesn't keep it from happening. So, but we are blessed with our children. And we like each other most of the time. Kyle came home and stayed too long. And got real tense. And where it usually shows is in mine and Jack's relationship, because we're real good at punching. "Why don't you do something?" And he has a really bad Al-Anon. And let me tell you, I don't do too well sometimes myself when it's my kid, you know. And so anyway, we finally had sat down for one of those talks. And and Jack had been real firm. I was the wavering one. This one sort of surprised me. It was like we decided to change position. But anyway, Kyle was getting ready to move out, and I said, "Kyle, do you know why I want you to leave?" And he said, "Why?" He knew part of the reasons, but he said, "Why?" And I said, "So I'll be glad when you come home." Because it just got real eggshelly feeling in our house, you know. It just didn't feel good in our house. And so now he has his own place, and it is, it's so good to see him. And I talked about changing positions. I read a book one time called, I don't remember what it was called, just remember this part, but it talked about a skunk and a turtle.
And how a skunk reacts when they're angry or hurt, frightened. And you know how a skunk reacts. And they talked about how a turtle reacts, how they pull in. And there was a little asterisk at the bottom of the page, and it says, it's surprising how often a skunk and turtle marry each other. And there was absolutely no doubt in my mind which one I was. And it did say that sometimes they do change roles. And we're both pretty pure. Well, I stayed pretty skunk, and he stayed pretty turtle. And I would react like a skunk does. I would get really stinky. And when I did, he pulled in. He pulled his head and everything else, and he went far away from me. And when he went in, I got scareder, and I got worse. And when I got worse, he went more in. And we kept doing this for a long time. And then we started learning how to live on a daily basis a different way. And I stopped being quite so stinky. He stuck his head out a little bit, and the procedure reversed. And he was pretty much out, and I was mostly nice. And I told this story one time, and someone came up, and they said, you're not a skunk. You're so sweet. And I said, no, I'm a skunk. God made me a skunk, you know, and I haven't forgotten how. So watch it. But God, working through the program, has partially deodorized me. And I always want to thank AA for what you've given us. And I thank Jack so much for what he's given me. And I had something else to go on the end of that, but I forgot what it was. Anyway, I do thank the program of AA. Oh, I know what I was going to say. Jack thanks the program of Al-Anon. That's what I was going to say. He's most grateful. He has suggested sometimes that I might want to go to a meeting. And, we traveled in a motorhome for 5 years, and that's a lot of togetherness. Being together 25 hours a day in a little motorhome is a whole lot. We've had our own meetings, and we open with the Serenity Prayer. Jack would read the fifth chapter if we were out in the somewhere, and we've gone to meetings different places throughout the United States. This was a neat time. This was a real, real desire of my heart to see the United States, and I just think it's so beautiful. I just think this place is so beautiful. You're really blessed. One of the things, one of the changes, the big changes in our lives is just what this program is about, what your conference is talking about, is the spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it. And when we came in the program, I use we a lot because it's been a we program. I have found out how to separate us. I am an I, and he is a he. And there's a whole lot of we stuff together too. And when Jack said God, it usually had a by in the front of it or a damn at the end of it. It was not with reverence. I wasn't sure what I thought or what I believed. I knew from the things that had happened to me when I had had the surgeries that I told you about earlier. I'd had the surgery 9 times, and I knew things had happened. When the man told me that God had something special for me to do, I knew it. I still know it. It may be nothing more than just giving you a smile that nobody else can give you but me. But I've got something special to do. And so we started. God, is, as we understood him, sounded God calling? sounded wide and broad and happy and safe. And I reached a point that I needed something more, and I needed to go back to church, and I could do it. I could do it without bumping Jack's bed, you know, without sighing at him. And I did it for me, because I needed to do that. And then things started happening for Jack, and church is part of our life now. It did not start that way, and maybe one of the words I hear more than any other is process. And it's been a process, and it's been a slow and gentle and good and just right where we are. And it's just like, I think how God ripens a peach. You know, a peach doesn't just dance up and down on the branch and hurry up and say, ripen me quicker today. A peach just does what a peach does and ripens in God's time. And this is the way our spiritual program has been. We have just ripened as our willingness has come into contact with God's will. And we were, our kiddos, we would say the blessing, particularly after Kyle came in. Kent and Chris were 9 and 10 when Kyle was born. We started doing some things again as a family. And we started Santa Claus. But things got fun. It's fun when you get a new little person in the house and you see through some different eyes. So we would say our blessing, we'd bow our heads and say, God is great, God is good, let us thank Him for our food. Then one day we were sitting at the bar. We were living in Austin. We were sitting out, had a little house on the lake. We were sitting at the bar, and all of a sudden, it's just Jack and me. And we're still saying, God is great, God is good, let us thank Him for our food. And there is absolutely nothing wrong with that prayer. But we talked a whole lot in our program. He talks to a lot of people. I have people that call me. And we talk a lot about prayer. And the steps talk about prayer. Sought through prayer and meditation. And to improve a conscious contact with God, as you understand Him. And I said, Jack, do you think we could just start trying to just pray? And do you know what? This was really scary. It's easy to talk about prayer at night. It's easy to talk to other people and tell them what to do. And it's something, it's very intimate. And we started, and it wasn't easy. And we sort of stumbled, and then we started praying. When we started praying together, and Jack prays for me every morning. We hold hands. He did it just before we came in here. We sat on the beach out there. He reached over and took my hand and asked that I say what I'm supposed to say, and then praise the Lord. You can say another tacked on to that, let you hear what you're supposed to hear in case I foul up. But anyway, we do. And he asks for my protection, and I pray for his protection and for all the other people on the highway where he's driving. But it's special. It's really special. I just know when Jack's prayed for me that it's heard. So I went to an Al-Anon meeting. We were doing this and it was feeling good, and I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and this young guy, never seen him since, but he was telling about, since he'd come into the program, his sponsor told him to get out on his knees, and he went home, and he was sleeping in the living room on a couch that opened up, and his dad just wouldn't go to bed, and he was getting sleepy, and he wanted to go to bed, and he finally said to his dad, Dad, I've started praying, and I'm ready to go to bed. So he knelt down, and my hands got clammy. You know, I felt my hands getting clammy. I thought, that takes a lot of courage, you know, to do that. It's real easy, you know, to sling a few seeds of prayer up to God as you're driving down the highway and everything. But getting down on your knees, and I thought, I'm going to commit to doing that. And I hadn't done it. It was not easy for me to do. And I know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that God doesn't care where I pray. You know, He really doesn't. I can be in the car, on the pot, in church, wherever. This was a commitment for me to do. It's a sign of reverence that He really is my higher power. And so I started doing it. I felt sort of embarrassed in front of Jack, you know. And sometimes the people that we live with, those people that it's the hardest to share those innermost things in. And this takes healing. And I still don't do it real good. Nearly always, last night, I got in bed and I was really sleepy. I still get in bed, and the thought always crosses my mind, you can just pray lying down. It takes my will to make me get up out of bed and to kneel down and to thank God for today. And mostly I stay in today. And mostly I don't have those bad days that I read about. You know it's a bad day when, because I have you to... If I get off on a bad day, I have you to tell me those simple things that I forget sometimes. I needed to hear over and over. And to hear the Serenity Prayer with fresh ears. My dad was in a depression. My brother called me and told me that Daddy had tried to kill himself, had tried to shoot himself. And I got in the car and I went over there, and I was so angry. It was like a hot tornado. I went in that house. I said, "What do you think you're doing?" And it was much longer in the program before I found how my fear is masked like an M&M chocolate. The fears inside, the anger covers it up. The brittle outside anger covers up the fear that's on the inside. And so it was up to me. I called a doctor friend, and he said that he really needed to be hospitalized. And Jack and I had talked about this, and we had prayed together about this, because the depression was showing up in ways. So it was my lot to, I knew that I had to do it, regardless of how he felt about me. He had to be given this chance to get better. So I took him to the hospital, and he said, "Gene, I'm not crazy." And I said, "Daddy, I know you're not." But I said, "We get sick in ways that we can't heal, and we have to have help." So when I left him in the hospital, they gave me, you know, the things in his pocket, his knife and stuff, and his belt. And then they closed the door, and I kept waiting for a reaction, my normal reaction. I was on the way to an Al-Anon meeting. And I was driving, and I thought, why am I not crying? Why don't I feel bad? But it was, I knew I had done what I needed to do. And then it was like God said to me, "Pat, you've been praying the Serenity Prayer to me. You have asked me for serenity to accept things you can't change. And you asked me for courage to change the things you can. And you asked me for wisdom to know the difference. I gave them to you, and you didn't know how to receive the gift." I didn't recognize serenity when it hit me right in the face. Thought there was something wrong with me. So, and this happens sometimes. I wait for a reaction that's an old pattern, and when it doesn't happen, I know that God's on duty. You know, whether I'm really too much in tune that day, he stays on duty. Daddy did fight with 5 years, and he did. He shot himself in our home, in our bathroom. And Mother had gotten worried, and she came to get me at the hospital where I was working. Went up there, and again I knew, at the point of my need, not a minute before, not a minute late, God's going to be right there. And there was a power within me that there was no doubt at all. It did not come from me. I don't have that kind of stuff. Jack had gone over to Floyd Ada to check on the elevator, and he came home. My friends were there, and again, they didn't say, "How can I help you?" They said, "I'll take Kyle to get a hamburger." And I made coffee. I somehow still think to make coffee first and then pray. I'm in the process of hoping that'll change. But when the police got there to make the investigation, I asked them if they'd like coffee. There was a calm, a real quiet calm, a real peace that passes all understanding, all human understanding. And I think one reason Jack talks so much about pride, and that I've soaked so much in, that these gifts that we've been given are not of our doing. And it's when it's the gratitude that you are given this special gift, this power that's so much greater than we are. And we did the things that needed to be done. And I fell in love with Jack all over again as I watched him do the things for my mother that needed to be done. And my brothers, who were so much younger than I, there was a bonding between us. So there is absolutely never a day that is so bad, even if you're behind a bunch of Hell's Angels and your horn gets stuck. There's got to be something good out of it. Maybe one of them needs the program and you're sent to, wouldn't that be a thought? But I don't believe there's a situation that is so bad that God does not bring good out of it. And one more little quick story. Tornadoes converged in Lubbock one time, and one of my fears is storms. I was so mad at Jack because he wasn't there protecting me. And when he came in, every window in his car had been blown in. I always think this is a neat story. All of his insurance papers were just matted with the rain. And his big book that Johnny had made a hand-tooled leather jacket for was not even wet. And I think that just went out the window. You know what I you know what I think? I think my time is up. And I think God just said, Pat, sit down and start listening. I thank you all very much.